BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. In the 19th century, Canada, for Irish people, is a place to run away to, from wars and bad politics and poverty. But the incomers find this new world rough and raw. Life is a lot of hard work, especially for domestic servants.
Wanted: strong kitchen girl, able to bake, wash, milk, and feed calves, age not under 18. Wanted: a respectable, steady young woman as servant of all work. She must be a plain cook and have a 12-month character from her last situation.
I lived servant during the 3 years that I have been in Canada at various places. Alderman Dixon's, Mr. McManus, Mr. Coates, and Mr. Harity. In June last, I went to live with Thomas Watson, shoemaker on Lott Street. Nancy Montgomery used to visit there, and I was hired as a servant by her for Mr. Kinnear at $3 per month.
Welcome back to Lady Killers, the programme that mixes true crime with history, but with a twist. We're taking a look, a feminist look actually, at the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses from Victorian Britain, North America and beyond. You just heard the words of Grace Marks, a servant, an immigrant from Ireland, recently employed in the household of Thomas Kinnear. There was also a housekeeper, Nancy Montgomery, and a farmhand, James McDermott. It's in this household, on a summer's day in 1843, that a grisly murder takes place. Joining us today to explore the case is Dr. Julia Shaw, a criminal psychologist from University College London and the host of the BBC Sounds podcast, Bad People. Hello, Julia.
Hi.
And we'll also be helped by historian Dr. Susan Houston from York University, Toronto. We're going to hear from her in a bit, but first, let's go to the location of the murder. Richmond Hill, just north of Toronto in Ontario.
My name is Maggie McKenzie. I am the Heritage Services Coordinator, and we are at the Richmond Hill Heritage Centre. The house is very typical of homes that the gentry built and was very upscale. Thomas Kinnear's home would have been very similar, but his house had another level, what we would call a story and a half.
Well, Thomas Kinnear was a Scottish immigrant. He came here in 1794. He was a single man, never married. He enjoyed his time with the ladies. He hired Nancy as his housekeeper, or I would say house manager. That was her job. Grace Marks was hired as the maid. So she did a lot of the more traditional laundry and dishes. Nancy managed her, as well as James McDermott, the farmhand. So the parlor was the part in a home where the family gathered, mostly for special occasions. Would have had the nice furniture, photos, the doilies on the fireplace. It would have been very ornate. This is the kitchen. The center of the home would have been the kitchen. There were four doors off here. All the four doors were bedrooms. I would say Grace was probably more downstairs by the kitchen. James probably had his space out in the barn.
On Sunday morning, the 30th of July, a neighbour called James Newton arrives at Thomas Kinnear's house for lunch. But the house and the barn are empty. He's surprised and confused. He gathers a couple more neighbours and the three men search the house. They find a trail of blood. And opening the trapdoor leading down to the cellar, they discover the body of Thomas Kinnear. They send for the coroner.
When I arrived, I went down to the cellar and saw Kinnear's body in the wine cellar. There was no mark of gunpowder on his clothes. I saw the body opened and the ball passed through his heart. I moved the body and saw blood on the back of Kinnear's clothing, but not much blood on the cellar floor. There was considerable blood spattered on the wall, but none on the steps. I concluded that he was shot and then thrown down the cellar stairs. He seemed to have died instantly.
Nancy Montgomery's body isn't found until the following day.
The murdered woman was quite black in the face, a horrible sight to look upon. There was a white cloth round the neck, drawn tight to strangulation and tied in two knots.
The coroner returns to examine her body.
On further examination of the cellar, I found Nancy Montgomery's body doubled up under a washtub. Her body was in a putrid state of decomposition. When I opened up Nancy's body, I found that she was pregnant.
So two people are dead. But two other people, farmhand James McDermott and maid Grace Marks, are missing. It's a super gory killing, and all the details are laid out in the newspaper. What do you think, Julia?
It seems like a pretty typical unplanned murder in the sense that it sounds like it was rushed. It was poorly covered up. People obviously ran away quite quickly. And so it was really easy to discover that this happened.
This is a poorly planned, rather sort of mundane crime?
Yep.
Okay, interesting. And what does the way the scene's been left say to you?
In some ways, it says to me that it's remarkable how unremarkable it is, in the sense that we have, you know, a very domestic setting. We have people who live in the house, so this idea that sort of a threat can come from inside. We have this perhaps class dynamic going on between the maid and the person who owns and lives in the house.
Yes. What about these missing servants then? I mean, if you were confronted with this case, would you immediately think that they did it?
Not necessarily. I mean, it depends on what else has happened in the house. Are there things stolen? Is there sort of evidence that someone broke in? Is there, you know, what could there be that indicates any kind of motive? Something bad has happened. They panicked and they ran away. Whether or not they're the perpetrators, who knows?
This business of all the crime scene being described in the newspapers, we got the putrid state of decomposition. Ooh, would we get that in the paper today, do you think?
Yes, I think people love the gory details, and I wish that journalists were more conscientious when reporting on these kinds of details, but ultimately they come out, and ultimately someone's going to make a podcast about it, someone's going to talk about it, and people are going to be interested.
You've just made me feel really bad because we are making a podcast about it, aren't we?
years later.
Now, having escaped under the cover of darkness, Grace and James have a good head start on their pursuers. In Toronto, a friend of the murdered man, one Frederick Capriol, hears about the killing and he's determined that the suspects, these missing servants, should be caught. But he has trouble getting anyone in authority to act. He tries the police, no good. He tries the mayor, no good either. So in the end, Frederick Capriol hires a steamboat himself and he convinces the bailiff to accompany him with an arrest warrant. These two travel across the water of Lake Ontario to the town of Lewiston in New York State. And there, in a hotel, in the very early morning of the 31st of July, they surprise and capture the two missing people.
Christian Guardian, 2nd of August, 1843. Pursuit was made on Sunday night, and the man and woman were both fortunately caught there, brought back, and are now safe in the city jail. They had taken Mr. Kinnear's horse and wagon, and considerable property of his was found with them.
Now, that journalist clearly thinks that this is great. The guilty ones are being caught. But who are these supposedly wicked and guilty servants? Toronto historian Dr. Susan Houston. Who exactly is Grace Marks?
She was a young Irish Protestant immigrant who arrived with her father and, I believe, eight siblings in 1840 and came to Upper Canada, What is very odd is that her family takes no part and is not identified in her trial, except for her confession that says her father was a stonemason. The story is that she was not literate. Well, she certainly, obviously, didn't have a lot of schooling. She was very young. If she really was without family support, being in service was probably her best option. If she had not got that route, I mean, the rest is occasional prostitution, destitution, etc. Grace Marks got into the bottom rung, really, of the legitimate labour market. Irish and, to lesser extent, young English girls were the backbone of the servant class in the middle decades of the 19th century.
And what do we know about James McDermott?
I think it's odd that there was no one really very sympathetic to James McDermott right from the beginning. Partly, he was not a very handsome young man. He's portrayed as having dark, lank hair, and he's a swarthy complexion. And it's interesting that even the Catholic newspaper in Toronto, the Toronto Mirror, which was editorially vigilant to defend the interests of Irish Catholics and the urban poor generally, they didn't sympathise with James.
James McDermott is Irish too. He's arrived in Canada just a few years before this with no family. He's served in the military. He's worked as a servant before. And he's only 20 years old, but he seems older, doesn't he, Susan?
For whatever reason, whether he's just on the margin, whether it's his looks, whether it's his military career, which assumes that he is an adult, but he's treated as a man who was capable of orchestrating this atrocious deed. I mean, atrocious is used about 16 times in the newspaper reports. So he's not given the sympathy of youth.
There's really intense interest in this case, wasn't there?
But you see, the whole event was so sensational too, because a huge proportion of the population had servants. Even middling people had a servant. You could be murdered by your servant unprovoked. It was just sort of terrifying.
And the newspapers, they're just feeding that terror.
People loved these stories. I mean, it made them shiver. It made them worry. But they lapped it up because it was exciting. It was all naughty. But they also were reaffirmed in their own sense of how important it was that society be sober and disciplined and ordered. And what this represented was disorder.
So the servants are the suspects. But why would they want to kill their employer and their colleague, housekeeper Nancy? Grace and James did give testimony at the inquest into the deaths of Kinnear and Nancy Montgomery. But the papers couldn't publish what they said in case it prejudiced their trials. But we do have the confessions they made after their trials, where they reveal their motives. So let's take a look at these two confessions. I've got James's here, and it's springing out at me. Maybe he had a motive of resentment. He says here that the housekeeper, Nancy, was overbearing towards him, and he'd complained to the boss, Mr. Thomas Kinnear, about this. But he said, no, you've got to get on with it. Nancy is the mistress of the house. Now, it's perhaps not easy for James to have a female boss. And it also doesn't help that Nancy is pregnant and that Kinnear is probably the father.
And Grace Mark's confession, which is what I'm looking at, also talks about resentment and also talks about the housekeeper several times scolding McDermott for not doing his work properly and that she gave him a fortnight's warning.
He's under notice of getting sacked. Mm. Okay, so he might have been really annoyed about that. Quite extreme to kill somebody for that, though, would you say?
It is. And statistically, from what we know about murder today, I think it's much more likely that there's something else going on here, or that maybe it's a fight that gets out of control. And maybe that resentment could underpin a moment of anger, an outburst, and yeah, then you act in this way and kill somebody. So from what I'm reading in the Grace Marks confession, there's also greed and sort of
Stealing, yeah. Going off with the goodies. Do you find greed a likely explanation for a violent murder?
Yep.
Oh, you do?
Yep. I think the situation that gets out of control is still the most likely, but yeah. Then greed is sort of next.
I'm quite interested in Grace's recent history. Grace has already moved 5 times in her 3 years in Canada. This interests me. Clearly, servants are in demand. She's able to get new jobs. If she didn't like it in the household, if she felt resentment, I wonder why she doesn't just move on.
I've called this the banality of murder, where people will act usually out of an impulsive decision and sort of explosively react out of anger, for example, and kill somebody. And it can be over really quite mundane reasons. And that can be just anger or resentment. That can be greed. And once the decision is made, there's no going back.
Let's hear some of the accusations they throw at each other in their confessions, starting with James.
She and the housekeeper used often to quarrel, and she told me she was determined if I would assist her, she would poison both the housekeeper and Mr. Kinnear by mixing poison with the porridge.
And then he said Mr. Kinnear was going to the city in a day or two and would no doubt bring plenty of money with him. He would kill Nancy before Kinnear came home, and would shoot Kinnear when he came home, and would take all the money and valuable things he could. He had made me promise to assist him, and I agreed to do so.
We can then plunder the house, pack the silver plate and other valuables in some boxes, and go over to the States. I said, no, Grace, I will not do so. And she said I should never have an hour's luck if I did not do as she wishes me.
So, Julia, we've got two very different stories here. They can't both be true, can they? What do you think?
Well, Grace certainly sets it up that she was pressured into the situation, that it was all his idea.
And do you think it's more likely, given their age and gender, that James would have been the instigator rather than the 16-year-old girl?
Yes. Also, because statistically, men are much more likely to engage in murder, and they're much more likely in situation where there's two people committing a murder, they're likely to be the leading force. You know, cause if we're looking at statistics in general, certainly it's much more likely that he pressured her than the other way around.
I was so frightened that I ran out of the front door into the lawn. And as I was standing at the door, McDermott came out of the front kitchen door into the yard and fired at me.
Maybe she was just completely the victim here. What do you think about that?
I think if we believe her story, that she would not have been found guilty of a crime today. I think she probably would have been seen as a victim and not as a perpetrator.
I should not have done it. If I had not been urged to do so by Grace Marks. Grace Marks is wrong in stating that she had no hand in the murder. She was the means from beginning to end.
By the time he's making his confession, he was on his way to the gallows. He's lashing out maliciously. He's sort of demonizing her, isn't he?
And the idea that she's almost whispering in his ear to do these horrible things, and he is compelled to do them because she's whispering threats against his masculinity. If you don't do this, you're not a real man kind of language. Sounds a bit like a man trying to explain how a woman might convince him to do something.
Do you know, I think I believe Grace. Who do you believe?
I believe Grace.
James and Grace are tried separately. James goes first on the 3rd of November. There's great public interest. The crowd is so big that the floor of the courtroom seems to be giving way and everybody has to rush out. James, though, is said to be completely unmoved by the panic. Reporters give him a swarthy complexion, a sullen, downcast and forbidding countenance. Now, the only evidence against James, the only real evidence, is his having stolen some of Kinnear's property and having escaped to Lewiston. Even the counsel for the Crown admits that's all there is, but it's enough to convict. After all, he looks like a murderer, doesn't he, with his swarthy complexion. The jury take just 10 minutes to deliver a guilty verdict. And the date for James's hanging is set for November the 21st, just 2 weeks later. Before then, though, Grace's trial begins.
The trial of this unfortunate girl took place. The evidence, except in a few particulars, was the same as that, again, of McDermott. We did not hear in the whole course of the trial a tittle of evidence that would clearly establish her willing participation in the horrid crime.
Well, this newspaper, Dr. Julia Shaw, is clearly on Grace's side, isn't it? It's hard for them to believe that she was a murderer.
Which itself can be a form of sexism, to assume that a woman, a good Victorian, innocent angel of domesticity, couldn't be capable of such a thing, and it must be sort of the man.
It is scarcely to be supposed that without her consent and willing assistance, that McDermott would have undertaken and went through with such an infamous and diabolical piece of infamy. She looked around her with a degree of stupid apathy. Her appearance by no means indicated a mind oppressed with grief at the awful situation in which she was placed.
Some of the other newspapers, though, they're not so keen on Grace, are they?
Right. And this idea of a woman in court presenting as devoid of expression is so commonly mentioned that it's almost cliché. And it's astonishing that even in the 1800s, this was already a stereotype of this idea that someone who's hearing things put to them in court should be breaking down and crying, especially if they're female. And so any woman who doesn't have enough expression, any person who's accused of a crime and doesn't have enough emotion and empathy is either a psychopath or somehow guilty. I mean, they wouldn't have used the term psychopath at the time. They would have used moral insanity. A really quite cliche portrayal of how we expect people to react in courtrooms, particularly women.
I guess that still holds true today, does it? If people don't look upset, there's something wrong with them.
And disproportionately, women are held to that standard of you need to look sad and guilty and upset rather than what people would describe as heartless.
Yeah, yeah. So according to Grace, this is her story. It's James McDermott who's the ringleader. She is in fear of him. And in support of this, a bullet is found in the back of the kitchen door, just where she said that it should be when he shot at her. Against her, though, is the fact that she's wearing Nancy Montgomery's clothes when she's arrested, and she wears them during the trial as well. People think that she wouldn't have done that if she hadn't been innocent. At the end of the day, the jury finds Grace guilty. But it does recommend mercy that she not be hanged.
The Aberdeen Journal, 1843. The female was in tears during the whole of the proceedings, and at the sentence swooned and fell forward on the spikes surrounding the dock, which inflicted a wound on her breast, but not of a serious nature.
We've got some emotion at last here, although it's quite sort of novelistic, melodramatic emotion, swooning away. What do you make of this?
It's clear that she can't show the right amount of emotion, which is often a problem in how women are seen in courtrooms. And specifically here, she's showing too much, isn't she? She's sort of losing control over her emotion, which plays into the stereotype of the woman who can't really control what she feels.
Well, my goodness, she's just been told that she's about to lose her life.
She has, although I did find it interesting that the jury returned with a guilty verdict, but in quotes, recommended the unhappy prisoner to mercy. I guess you could superficially see this as what sometimes is referred to as the female discount, that compared to men, women often get lesser sentences or shorter sentences. But in this particular case, it also reflects the fact that she was probably, I would say, at best, his accomplice. So she should get a shorter sentence.
Yeah, I'm thinking that I would give her a discount myself for having been younger and weaker. She's 16 years old. There's a vulnerability to her that I feel like I should take into account, despite what you're saying about not judging people by their appearances. Okay, when we're talking about her position within the household being possibly that of a person who's being coerced, we can't prove this as a fact, can we?
Well, you rarely can.
But that is allowed to be taken into account.
Well, those are mitigating circumstances, right? That's how we would talk about them now, is that these are all things that should lessen her sentence, and they are taken into account in modern day courtrooms. These kinds of things are less strong than other evidence, like a bullet and a door, but still, it's ultimately, we only have their memories and their stories to go on. And so we need to make of it and try to piece together the most plausible story. I mean, the whole concept of how we weigh evidence is very gray and quite subjective, which is one of the reasons we have juries, because people will make these decisions differently, and we need to have a representative sample from the population to help with that.
Grace is spared from being hanged, and she goes to Kingston Penitentiary for a sentence of life imprisonment. But there is a group of men and women in Kingston who petition for a pardon for Grace, and finally, in 1872, they're successful. That year, the prison warder takes her across the border into the US. She's now in her early 40s. She goes to a job in a home where the family know her story, and at this point, she disappears from the historical record. Maybe Grace reinvents herself. Julia, what are your final feelings about this story of Grace Marks?
I hope that she was able to reinvent herself, whether she's guilty or not, especially if she's not, then I have obviously a lot of sympathy for her. But even if she is guilty of murder, as James McDermott described, she served her sentence. And I think we should allow and encourage people to, once they've served their time, to go back to whatever semblance of normality they can. And so I hope that she had a nice life afterwards.
I can't help feeling Grace was unlucky, but in a way that also applied to lots of other people. She loses touch with her family after her transatlantic crossing, and she finds herself a replacement family in the workplace, in this screwed-up household of Thomas Kinnear. This was in the 19th century, but you know what? It could still happen today. Work for lots of people still becomes a kind of toxic family situation where the people supposed to be in charge are behaving very badly and life becomes intolerable. Poor Grace. Well, it's goodbye and thank you to our guests, Dr. Susan Houston, Maggie McKenzie, and Dr. Julia Shaw. Next time on Lady Killers, a nurse in Victorian England is accused of killing hundreds of children entrusted to her care. Don't miss an episode. Just search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Sandra Bartlett. Our resident historian is Rosalind Crone. The music's composed by Asher Nathan and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Colleen Prendergast and William Hope. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hi, I'm Greg Jenner and Your Dead to Me from Radio 4 is back. Yes, we're the comedy show that takes history seriously. And this series, get ready to hear about Frederick the Great of Prussia with Stephen Fry.
I'm just thrilled at this history lesson.
Learn a fair old amount about an ancient Egyptian queen with Kima Bob.
What a vibe.
And for a stitch in time, we talk about the Bayeux Tapestry with Lou Sanders.
Oh, I'm agog.
All alongside a host of brilliant historians. That's You're Dead to Me. Listen and subscribe on BBC Sounds.
Johnny Good, isn't it?